Scarborough.
May it please the court, Brian Scarborough on behalf of Amicus appointed to present arguments in favor of petitioner Roger Grant. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. In section 1915B of the PLRA, Congress used the words civil action and appeal, words with well-known meanings. Civil action being the one form of action in a district court, appeal being a review of a final decision of a district court or certain interlocutory orders of a district court. Mandamus, as this court has made clear on multiple occasions, is neither a civil action nor an appeal. And the government has cited no cases from this circuit that are to the contrary.
And doesn't a following of the literal classification lead courts to classify habeas as civil? That is the traditional. I know in many ways, obviously, it's not a good label, and sometimes courts use the term hybrid. But surely we don't want habeas petitions to be covered by
That's
this,
right.
Do we?
In fact, the court in the Blair Bay decision specifically carved out habeas, holding it as to be, while it's technically or nominally civil, it's considered to be something different, a special proceeding. It's carved out from the PLRA unless civil claims are brought with it as well in a mixed petition, or unless the petition is brought labeled as habeas but is in fact civil. And the same thing can be done with mandamus. It's also a special sort of proceeding. It's not used to initiate an action or to review the final decision of a district court. It's used to compel the lawful exercise of authority of a district court judge. It's aimed at the actions of a district court judge.
There's certainly, at least it seemed to me, I know courts say that interlocutory appeals under Cohen are completely different from mandamus, but for years I've had the greatest difficulty telling what that difference is. I think, in honesty, in your case, it looks much more like mandamus than a Cohen appeal. But are you ready to take the view that a Cohen interlocutory appeal should be covered by 1915B?
I think interlocutory appeals should be covered. They're considered traditionally to be appeals in the statutes that define what appellate courts can hear as an appeal. Final judgments, final decisions is one, and certain interlocutory orders are another. But mandamus is not. It's clearly not an interlocutory order that can be appealed.
But essentially you're following, on that, as opposed to the habeas, you're adopting a view that the formal classifications control. Given the fact that all courts facing the issue have treated habeas as criminal, not civil, it seems to me that's hard to do.
Well, I think you can look at the substance of what mandamus is trying to do as well. Just like habeas is trying to do something other than a civil action appeal, so too with mandamus. It's aimed at controlling the exercise of a district court's authority, such as failure to docket a complaint or a notice of appeal, failure to follow a mandate of a district court or a mandate that an appellate court's ordered. Those are different. The substance of what it's getting at is different from an appeal, not simply the nominal procedural name as well. And it's consistent with the PLRA's purpose as well.
It depends how broadly you define things. If the category is an appellate court's correction of a district court or consideration of whether a district court needs to be corrected, then they're all members of that species, are they not?
I think on the margins there could be some questions, but at least for mandamus that we're dealing with here, the transfer order is clearly not an appeal, and it's serving a different function as what an interlocutory appeal would serve. And it's consistent with how this court treats habeas, as I discussed, but also with
With respect to habeas, isn't in Blair Bay that basically the court's saying that habeas is really more criminal than civil, notwithstanding the technical classification? Because it has to do with confinement and the duration of confinement, and it has to do with whether criminal prosecution conviction was correct or not. But mandamus in the circumstance, and a mandamus connected to a habeas would similarly have the same point. But this mandamus has nothing to do with that.
That's right. This mandamus is brought in and underlying civil action. But
right.
In Blair Bay, the court also was looking at more of a substantive distinction as well for habeas, that not just that it's tied to a criminal action, but that it's serving a different function as a standard civil action or an appeal would serve, just like mandamus does.
Does 1915b1 apply to the Supreme Court?
I'm sorry, to
does
Supreme
it apply
Court?
To the Supreme Court?
If it's a writ of certiorari, that's generally considered a extraordinary writ, and it may not fall within the gamut of a traditional appeal from a district court.
Do you know whether there's been any decision about that? I mean, that applying B1 to certiorari petitions with the idea in mind that a certiorari petition is in the nature of an appeal?
I don't know if there have been decisions on that basis. I would say that if it doesn't apply to certiorari, there would still be the same bona fide test that you could use for mandamus. Obviously, a petitioner is trying to bring a certiorari petition.
Well, the reason I ask is there's at least a line of authority, historical authority, that treats certiorari and mandamus as basically related writs for controlling the actions of lower courts. And if certiorari is treated in the nature of an appeal, it seemed to me it almost would follow that mandamus should as well.
I think mandamus clearly is serving a different function than an appeal, and certiorari may well as well, depending on the issue that's being presented.
You'd say mandamus is not a continuation of the action begun in the lower court, that it's a new proceeding?
That's right. It's an original proceeding.
But if we treat it that way, then why isn't it a civil action, even though it's begun in the Court of Appeals? The Smith case did exactly that, treated the action begun in the Court of Appeals as a civil action.
Well, the Smith case was particularly focused on the fact that in the petition itself there were claims for compensatory and punitive damages. So,
well, that was only part of it. There was also a request for an order.
There was against the parole commission. It wasn't
right.
An order against a district court judge like mandamus. And the court hung its hat, or appeared to, on the fact that there were these civil damage claims in it, and that's why it was.
I don't. Yeah, but that would mean only part of it was not covered.
Well.
I don't see that distinction in Smith. I have it here, but I'm not going to get it out. Lumped it all together.
Well, on page 1250, the court specifically tied its holding to the fact that the petition included claims for compensatory and punitive damages, and that's why it was being treated as subject to the PLRA and wouldn't allow the petitioner to drop those claims.
Yeah, well, we know it wasn't an appeal.
That's right.
Right. And so we've got three elements, a punitive, compensatory, and then the order correcting the records of the parole commission? Correcting the records of the parole commission. I don't think that's a writ of prohibition, by the way, at least not traditionally. It's more in the nature of a mandamus. But nevertheless, the court treated that as a civil action.
It did.
So my question was, remember, my question was, that if you said this is a new proceeding, not a continuation of the civil action in the district court, well, if it is a new proceeding, why isn't it, doesn't Smith, it follows from Smith that it's a civil action?
Well, I don't think it follows. For one, mandamus isn't considered to be, it's not considered to be an independent action. It's an aid of this court's existing appellate jurisdiction, but it's also not considered to be an appeal. It's used to preserve a future power of review in this court of a district court decision. And the petition in Smith brought in this court in the first instance, one doesn't seem to be after the same thing that mandamus under 1651 is after, that is controlling the authority of or the exercise of an appellate or a district court's authority. It was aimed at correcting the records of a parole commission, which a much different case could be made that could be considered to be a civil action, at least if it's brought into the district court, which seems like it should have been in the first instance. And I think it's this idea of carving out bona fide mandamus petitions, which the government says is unworkable, isn't unworkable. It's a pretty straightforward rule. It's what this court traditionally, you look at the relief that's sought in this court. If it's relief that this court is traditionally allowed to be pursued in mandamus, it's a bona fide petition and shouldn't be subject to the fee. The Third Circuit's been engaging in this analysis since the 90s in Madden. There's no evidence that that's proven to be unworkable or led to a flood of mandamus. This court appears to engage in that analysis in Smith because it's with its unpublished decisions that it followed Smith and specifically held that Smith carves out bona fide mandamus, at least for purposes of 1915G of the PLRA. And that hasn't proven to be unworkable in this circuit as well. And it's a test that I think is straightforward and that this court already engages in a different realm with habeas in making initial threshold determinations of habeas. If a petition, habeas petition is mixed, it's subject to the PLRA. If it's masquerading as habeas but really a civil action, it's subject to the PLRA under the Blair Bay decision. The same sorts of threshold determinations can be made by this court with mandamus.
Can we just go back to the Third Circuit? I mean, that Madden is a habeas case followed by a writ, quest for a writ from the Third Circuit. So why isn't that simply in accord with the general principle that you look at the action when the Court of Appeals is facing something which is a quest for some sort of appellate review, you look at the nature of the action in the district court?
Well, the Madden case in the Third Circuit actually went beyond that and looked at the actual relief that's being sought. It says in that decision that regardless of the nature of the underlying action, be it criminal or civil, mandamus is not subject to the PLRA. it's not the underlying action that matters. It's the relief that's being sought in the petition itself. And if the petition is simply a way to avoid the filing fee requirements of the PLRA, it's dressed up as mandamus but really isn't, then it's subject to the fee. But if it's a true mandamus petition, seeking relief that traditionally has been permitted to be sought in mandamus, then it's not. I see I'm going into my rebuttal time. I just wanted to quickly address
the merits. Before you do, let me just ask you about this language from Smith. Although Congress did not define the term civil action for purposes of the PLRA, we conclude that it includes a petition for a writ of prohibition that, like Smith's, includes underlying claims that are civil in nature.
That language, if you read further along on page 1250,
right.
The court does say that, but there are no underlying claims in that action. It's a petition brought in the initial instance in the appellate court. There was no underlying action, and the court focuses its holding on the fact that the petition in the appellate court, not anywhere else, not in the lower court, included these damages claims, and that's why it was not. That's why it was subject to the fee. If I could I just wanted to address the merits really very briefly on the transfer order. It's addressed in our brief. Our position is that the district court lacked the power to order transfer for improper venue since transfer for the official capacity claims were proper in this district. That's a proper basis for mandamus. If the district court wants to transfer those official capacity claims, it may be able to do so under 1404. That's an issue that needs to be decided in the district court in the first instance. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We'll hear from Mr. Schwabe.
Alexander Schwabe, representing the appellee. The Informa Pauperis Statute, 1915, indicates what the intent was with regard to the civil criminal distinction, and the fact that as this court held or found in Smith, the fact that the underlying action is civil should be determinative of whether or not the petition falls under the PLRA. Well, if you look at
Smith is different in its characterization of underlying action. It did not involve use of mandamus for an appeal at all. I mean, for appellate request for appellate review at all. The underlying action was the action, and the court naturally looked at the action that it had before it, which was the possible exception, a standard quest for civil relief, right?
As I believe...
It talks about the underlying action, but it was the action before the court that the court was talking about.
Well, again, there were several different issues in the underlying Smith case. There was the correction of the parole records, along with the fact that there were damages requested in the actual action. But the Smith court said specifically that the determinative factor is whether the underlying action is civil, and that's what they would look to as underlying action. And then it looked to Martin.
All I'm saying is that the underlying action of which they were talking about was not like the underlying action here, in that it was the action in the Court of Appeals, while here there is an underlying action in the district court, or was.
I believe that's correct with regard to one
aspect. It seems to me that may well make a difference.
Well, with regard to what the Smith court said, I don't believe it does, Your Honor, because the Smith court said, in citing Martin as well as Madden, as well as Nagy, as well as a number of other circuits, that the fact that the underlying case is civil is the key. And I understand what Your Honor is saying, is that the facts of Smith are slightly different, but that doesn't mean that what Smith said was not that one should look at the underlying civil case in making the determination as to whether or not the writ should be under the PLRA. I mean, that was the rule of Smith.
I hear what you're saying.
Now, again, going back to the statute, if you look at 1915A, which describes the gamut of cases that Congress intended to be covered by the PLRA, I mean, by the informal pauper statute, rather, states any suit, action, or proceeding, civil or criminal, or appeal thereof. In other words, there they stated the gamut of cases for prisoners or non-prisoners that we're going to say can be covered by informal paupers or can get informal pauper status in our discretion is civil and criminal. Then if you go further into the statute, into G, for example, the three strikes, using that same language, they focus only on the civil. They leave out the criminal in talking about three strikes. And then if you go to B1, which is what we're faced with here today, the PLRA, it says, notwithstanding subsection A, if a prisoner brings a civil action or files an appeal in a form of pauperis, the prisoner shall pay the filing fee. They make the distinction between civil and criminal, and then they go right further in statute and they say, but in civil cases, and there's no indication, no reason to believe that they don't anticipate extraordinary writs like mandamus that are civil in nature to also be covered under civil cases. Those are the cases that should be under the PLRA for the purpose of paying the initial filing fee. And Smith, again, I understand what Your Honor is saying about the underlying facts, but Smith still, in its statement, in its following of Martin specifically, says the underlying civil action is what is determinative.
What do you do with all the orders that we've issued that say that the mandamus is not covered by 1915b1?
Well, Your Honor, those are unpublished decisions.
Why does that matter?
Well, I don't believe they're considered precedential as
unpublished. Where do you get that from?
Well, Your Honor, that's my understanding of
But where does that understanding come from? We've never said that, have we?
Well, I think part of the basis for the understanding is that there's no real reasoning provided in the decisions. There's no decision provided. It simply states a ruling, and that's the end of it. And there's no way to understand what the basis for that is.
That's true of published opinions sometimes as well.
Your right answer here ought to be to at least look at the rule. And we actually have two rules that don't resolve this very well. We have both of them are our local rules. Rule 32.1 says that unpublished dispositions entered on or after January 1st, 2002, which is included in this group, may be cited as precedent. That means you and your opposing counsel can cite them as precedent, which would suggest that they are precedent. Then we have Rule 36. E, which is the federal rule itself, which says, while unpublished dispositions may be cited to the court, Well, maybe this may be our own rule.
That's right.
That's also our rule. An unpublished disposition means that the panel sees no precedential value in that disposition. Now, could you resolve for us the meaning of our own rules?
My suggestion in the way of a resolution is follow the latter rule.
But see, that would cover if there are eight orders, I think by one count there are eight of these orders, that the latter rule that Judge Garland cited would cover the last seven of them, right? Because they don't have any, once the precedent was set, then the orders that follow don't have any additional precedential value.
Well, the further trickiness here is I think all the orders only cite In re Smith. They don't cite each other even.
Well, I guess my response to that would be, Your Honor, that the one case in this circuit that has discussed the issue we're here before on today is the Smith case. And the Smith case, again, states rather clearly that the underlying action is what's determinative, and the underlying action being civil was determinative in that case. And in following Martin, which made the same ruling,
I understood their argument being that it's not that it's not civil, it's that it's not an action.
Well, B1, again, I believe that the statutory construction, which I mentioned earlier, I think answers the question in that it has to be, it should be considered civil, because there's no reason that the drafters would have wanted to prevent mandamus in a civil action from being something that you could get informa pauperis status for under 1915. Mm-hmm.
Why is it under, you keep saying the underlying action, what's underlying about that action? It's the action. I mean, it began in the Court of Appeals, in Smith, mm-hmm. began in the Court of Appeals. There's nothing underlying about it. That helps you in this case if you characterize it that way, but I don't see why that's a proper characterization of Smith.
The reason I used that language, Your Honor, is because that is the language that I think Smith uses when it states, by contrast, three circuits have held that petitions for mandamus or prohibition that are predicated on underlying civil claims fall within the range of actions that Congress sought to subject to
PLRA. Yeah, well, that's
another
case. That's what other circuits had, and that's the issue before us. Let me ask you, do you know what the answer is? I don't, about the certiorari petitions. Are they covered by B1?
I don't know the answer, Your Honor. But I would, B1 appears to be, again, I don't think there's any reason to believe that B1 was not meant to cover, because A is such a broad statement of who's covered by B1. They talk about non-prisoners.
There is a filing fee for cert petitions, isn't there? For private. I don't think the government has to pay.
Speaking of filing fees, Your Honor, you're reminding me of a point that I wanted to make with regard to Blair Bay. But Blair Bay talked about habeas being different and set habeas aside from 1915. Because it is in essence a different proceeding and a criminal proceeding. But another issue, I believe, here, and this goes to the purpose of the PLRA, is that a habeas petition costs $5 to file. The PLRA, to do a mandamus petition, is going to cost $455. And that goes to the intent, I believe, of the drafters of the PLR, was to prevent, to stop the burdensome filing of litigation of civil cases. And in doing so, they meant that to address all forms of civil action, the civil action, an appeal, and a mandamus, which I would say is essentially an appeal. With regard to the Madden case and the Third Circuit and the bona fide argument that is pursued by appellant, the court in Madden itself talked about what needs to happen for this bona fide analysis to take place. And they're basically asking for the case to first be looked at by a civil clerk, and then a filing fee to be paid, and then ultimately reviewed by the court. The purpose of the PLRA was to cut down on the burdensome nature of these actions. And to have this exercise take place every time there's a mandamus filed is to have them look at it on two separate occasions to make this determination is clearly going to be time-consuming, clearly going to be burdensome, and flies directly in the face of what was intended by the drafters.
Well, if we knew what was intended by the drafters, this would be a lot easier. There's no legislative history, right, except for a few floor discussions. There's no Senate report. There's no House report. We have the language in front of us. We know it has to do with prison litigation, but we don't know much more than that.
There's some language in the cases that indicates that they are trying to cut down on the burdensomeness of these filings. And the
I guess the question is which filings,
right?
Is it the burden,
well, again,
which they're trying to cut down
and,
on?
And I would go back to the statute for that, Your Honor. I mean, why would they say at the beginning civil and criminal, prisoners and non-prisoners, and then when they go on to the statute, specifically in the PLRA, in B1, would they limit it to civil? It doesn't seem logical that they would say civil but not mandamus. A is meant to cover all actions, and the division into civil and criminal that is called for in B and restated in G, I think answers the question for us, that they meant for it to cover all of these actions. The court has taken habeas out because habeas is a separate beast, but mandamus is not.
Are we taking it out because habeas is a separate beast, or because it's more of the dichotomy you raise? In the taxonomy, it's more criminal than it is civil.
It's more criminal than it is civil, but I believe it also is a separate issue, and I also think that the fact that there's, I think it's a different entity dealing with a prisoner being able to question the basis for his conviction, and because it is more in the nature of criminal action. Quickly, with regard to the merits of the case, Your Honor, the transfer in this case was proper. All of the actions did take place in Pennsylvania, all actions complained of by Grant. And this court itself has held in the Tripatti case that decisions with regard to transfer of venue can only be overturned in cases of abuse of discretion. And we would say that in a situation in which the majority, all the acts took place in Pennsylvania, it was not an abuse of discretion for this to happen. In addition, the appellant, or the petitioner, was given an opportunity to have his dissatisfaction noted in his motion for reconsideration, which was read by the court and rejected.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal. So before you get too far into this, I want to raise a question which is raised by an argument just made but not quite completed, which is this. So your argument is that this is not an action, is that right?
That's right.
But obviously also that it's not a civil action.
Yes.
And it's not civil at all.
That's right. It's not.
It's not civil, right. So here's the problem then that opposing counsel's arguments puts to you, which is if you look at section 1915A, the only way that the petitioner here is entitled to IFP at all is if his suit, action, or proceeding is civil or criminal. And if it's neither civil nor criminal, then under the statute, he's not entitled to informa pauperis, and we don't even have to go on.
Well, 1915A uses very broad language to basically encompass any sort of proceeding,
but
civil or criminal.
Civil or criminal. It doesn't say civil or criminal or mandamus or civil or criminal or something else. It does sound like it has to fall into one or the other of those two categories.
Well, I think it's like habeas. I think it's historically been regarded as technically civil. It has to be civil or criminal.
Okay, so that, I agree with that. So if that's the case, and I would put habeas into the criminal, and that explains why the habeas cases are not subject to B, because they're not a civil action or a civil appeal.
Well, I think habeas is not only, it's not just that it's criminal, but it's considered something different than just traditionally being a civil action. We're looking at civil actions as well, not just civil proceedings.
Well,
civil proceedings are used in A, much broader term.
It may be, but A, I want to know how that petitioner in habeas gets IFP under A if it's neither civil nor criminal.
It may well be considered either civil or criminal, but it's not a civil action or an appeal in a civil action for purposes of B1.
It has to be either civil or criminal. So the way it gets in is by it being criminal.
I think it can be criminal or it can be civil, but not considered a civil action.
Clearly civil because it's in 28 U.S.C. rather than 18 U.S.C.
It is traditionally considered civil, correct? It may not be considered. The Congress used the word civil action or appeal. It's not considered to be a civil action or an appeal. Now, it may still be considered criminal or civil, but not. It doesn't fall within what traditionally is.
The right, word civil is surplusage, though, isn't it?
I don't think it's surplusage. Your civil actions are the
what
one
other,
form of action.
I mean, I just, if you have a dichotomy between civil and criminal, we can all agree that prisoners can't bring criminal actions, right?
Yes.
So the only thing they can bring is civil, and the fact that the B1 uses the word civil action, therefore civil is surplusage.
I think it was meant to encompass what traditionally is considered to be a civil action, filing a complaint in district court. That's what the Congress is trying to deter prisoners from doing, and mandamus is something other than that. That's been clear in this court's decisions. I think there's also a policy point here as well. This mandamus petition for Mr. Grant is in effect trying to vindicate the fact that he has to pay a filing fee in district court. No one disagrees that his original civil complaint is subject to a filing fee, but he hasn't been permitted to have his day in court yet to go forward with that complaint. And he shouldn't have to come here if he qualifies for informa pauperis and pay another fee to challenge the initial.
Yeah, but suppose that something were going along in his district court action, which he felt and perhaps persuaded this court was subject to review under Cohen. There'd be no way out in that circumstance, would there?
As
I say, no way to relieve him of the need to file the fee.
As an interlocutory appeal, right, that's in effect trying to have another bite at the apple.
It isn't another bite. I mean, it's the reason for Cohen is that you have a potentially at least an error in the district court, which can never be remedied otherwise, and therefore you allow interlocutory appeal. And mandamus at least overlaps with that.
But I think, at least in this case, for the transfer order, it doesn't overlap. And
no, I understand that mandamus appears to be the remedy for errors in regard to a transfer order. But I mean, your point about putting the prisoner through burdensome, costly litigation applies every bit as much to a Cohen interlocutory appeal, but the statute would plainly require a filing fee then.
It shouldn't apply to mandamus, we submit, because of the substantive difference that mandamus is after.
In this example, if we were to allow an appeal, it would be a different standard of review than there is for mandamus, which is even harder. So that the reason that transfers are subject to mandamus rather than appeals are that it's even harder for us to interfere with a transfer. So why should it be that you get no fee if you ask us to do something even harder for us to do, but have to pay a fee if you ask us to do something that is easier for us to do?
I think it's because of what mandamus is after. It's controlling the lawful exercise of a district court's authority. It's asking this court to enter an order technically against a district court judge. It's not asking to review the merits, the legal analysis of a decision on final judgment or interlocutory appeal. That's a...
But an interlocutory appeal is reviewing the decision in the same way. The district court here decided to transfer the case. In another case, the district court may have decided to permit introduction of evidence, which perhaps your client might not like in an example. If we allowed an interlocutory appeal, we would direct the court to permit the introduction of the evidence. We don't do that. It can only be done through mandamus. Reason is, probably shouldn't do that except in the most extreme case. That's why the standard is so hard. Does it seem, you were asking from a policy point of view, which is the only reason I'm raising this question. It seems odd that for something that we make it really, really hard for you to prove, to establish, we should not require a fee, but for something which is slightly easier to establish, we would require a fee.
Well, I think using the word civil action or appeal would be consistent with that. I mean, just because it's hard, for one, that probably will relieve the burden concerns of the government. It's unlikely that a lot of mandamuses will go forward to consider the high standard. and the narrow category in which they can be brought. It's a traditionally narrow and circumscribed category that mandamus is there for.
Is your argument confined to a mandamus seeking a petition for a writ of mandamus against a judge?
We're arguing on mandamus under 1651A of
but the All Writs Act.
The right, which
so that applies to agencies though as well, right?
That's right.
Well, generally,
I don't see how you can maintain that if an action is brought in the district court seeking a mandamus against an administrative agency or an ALJ or whatever. You would agree, I take it you would have to agree that that's a civil action, right? Well,
mandamus under 1651A cannot be brought in the district court. So that's the mandamus that we're focused on here. It's specifically prohibited in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 81, for bringing mandamus.
Well, you don't call it mandamus.
Mandamus under 1361A against an agency is separate, and that does, the district courts do have original jurisdiction over that. That's not what we're asking, that's not what we're dealing with here.
It's just a label. I mean, it could be in the nature of a mandamus petition begun in a district court, but the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure say it abolish the distinction and just call it a civil action for an injunction. I mean, that's the only difference.
Well, it serves it's aimed at a federal officer or an agency, not a district court judge like traditional mandamus under 1651 is. That's one distinction, and the rules may well consider it to be a civil action. But mandamus that we're dealing with here under 1651, much different than that.
Well, we have a lot of people. No. I'm just going to use them as an example. A lot of people out there waiting for a FERC case. If a prisoner complains that FERC is taking too long to decide a case, the normal approach would be to file mandamus in this court. No IFP? I mean, he gets informal purpose for that.
Traditionally, that is one avenue for mandamus, right? Failure to great delay in rendering decision, failure to docket civil action or appeal. The courts has put that into the narrow category where it feels mandamus.
So if the warden is taking too long to resolve an issue of the prisoners, can he file for mandamus here?
Sorry, if who?
The warden of the prisoner's prison is taking too long to decide on some issue that the prisoner regards as significant.
Can a prisoner challenge bring mandamus against a warden?
Yes, for acting too slowly.
My understanding is that needs to proceed in the district court under 1361A. It has original jurisdiction over mandamus petitions against federal officers or agencies. Or actions in the nature of mandamus is what 1361A.
Unless the statute puts it here. Right.
And the burden, mandamus also has special rules to ease the burden. If that might potentially arise. It can be summarily denied by this court, and the government can't even respond to mandamus unless the court orders it. So there are ways of protecting against this avalanche of mandamus that is not even going to happen, but potentially. I think I've gone way over my time here. So,
thank you. Case will be submitted.